Think of all the books that have influenced who you are. Now, let's advance the conversation. In this podcast, I'll dig into topics that affect how you see the world by talking with authors who write about them. This is Cap Radio Reads. I'm Donna Epidoni. Today, you'll hear my conversation with author Robin Sloan in front of an audience of book lovers. Robin Sloan's first book had a lengthy title, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, but his second book has a simple name, Sourdough. It pokes fun at Silicon Valley's robots, flavorless protein drinks, and open-air markets. There's nothing revelatory about sourdough, but when the protagonist, Lois, starts using a robotic arm to help her make bread, it does make one wonder how far is too far when it comes to technology. It doesn't get any more San Francisco than sourdough. And sourdough is the perfect title for a book about various cultures in and around the Bay Area. And there are plenty of them. They kind of pile up: food culture, Saturday morning market culture, technology culture, microbiome culture, and sourdough bread culture. I asked author Robin Sloan when he knew he could merge them all.
I think that merging and that pile up, that kind of too much almostness, is kind of the reason to write novels in the first place. Truly, I mean, when you write a movie script or a TV script, there's just all these forces that are trying to kind of pare things down and streamline them, and just a lot of people saying like, oh, can we kind of make this smoother, polish this bit to a high gloss. Novels are not as polished. You know, they come out of one mind, usually, with the help of an editor or, you know, a team of folks at some point. But in their origin, it really is like the stew of a human brain.
What I think is interesting is that you don't make us choose. In fact, you don't choose whether it's going to be one technology or another, old technology or new technology, old style anything or new school. You feel like there's a third option.
Oh, always. And I wouldn't even call it a third option. I would call it a different conjunction. I think that's the right word. I feel like the word that I always hear, I see it in headlines, and I'm sure you folks do too, on episodes of, you know, talk shows and very smart, very sort of erudite public radio panels. The word is or. People always say or, like, what will it be? You know, technology or humanity? What will it be? Digital books or print books? And I just reject the or. It seems natural to me. Nothing could be more natural than saying and instead. Maybe I'm just greedy. I want all the things. I want technology and I want my humanity. I want ebooks when I travel. I want print books at home and. I want it all. So I guess I'm just trying to convince people of that.
Everybody always wants to know the background of a writer, and I was surprised to find out, I did not know, you were trained as a journalist.
I was, that's right. I sad to say, I didn't really put much of that training into practice.
This isn't all true?
No. I mean, I was trained as a journalist. It was my first job out of school, and boy, what an amazing job. I had gotten an economics degree at Michigan State University, another piece of training that I never really used properly. And I went to work/learn at a place called the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. And anybody in the room who's kind of been affiliated with the world of journalism or even adjacent to it will have heard of Poynter. It's this legendary school for journalists, really part of kind of the halcyon age of newspaper journalism in America, which of course is threatened in a lot of ways right now. But short story, it's a place where really, really amazing journalists cycle through to learn themselves, you know, from each other, from masters of their craft. So imagine me not knowing anything about anything, least of all journalism, 22 years old, just graduated from Michigan State, down there in St. Petersburg, Florida, just soaking it up. And even though I never really properly became a reporter or an editor, at least not in that mode, the things I learned there, particularly the things I learned about writing, have influenced everything that's happened since.
There's another side of your brain that works all the time, too, though. You've developed apps. You've written, you know how to write code. You do all those things that make my head spin.
They shouldn't. They shouldn't make your head spin. I think, one of the things that I always push back so hard against is this term and this concept of the digital native. You know, I'm sure you've heard this. Like, oh, kids these days, they grew up with the internet. And they just have never known a world without the internet. So they have this built-in kind of, you know, intuition, or they're just these adepts. And I don't think that's true. I don't think it's right. I actually, based on my own experience of the world and encountering people, I think that that knack and certainly that interest, that curiosity, is perfectly evenly distributed across ages and generations. I know some very young curmudgeons who would like nothing more than to like be the editor of a print newspaper in 1962. And conversely, I know folks who've been retired for decades who are, they are the first to get all the new gadgets and learn how to use them. So that's all to say that if I've had any advantage, it is maybe confidence. Ever since I was a kid using computers, they did seem natural to me and they seemed approachable. And when you're doing that kind of work, kind of one skill builds on the next, and you're always, when confronted with something new, instead of saying, oh, that's not me, that's not my world, you kind of go, this is interesting.
And that makes you sort of, the way you fit all of that together into the puzzle of a book makes you rather a curator of all of that.
I think that's right, yeah, a curator, a translator. I do, I kind of think of maybe my role or my place on the shelf as being somebody who does metabolize some of those things, perhaps for folks who don't find them quite so natural or so attractive. And if whenever someone tells me that one of my novels kind of opened up the world of technology or of code to them, I like put a little check mark
ding,
on the
ding,
wall.
Ding.
Yeah,
yes.
That's definitely a success.
Books are a big part of your books. I mean, you write books and they're physical books, but within your books are a lot of books. Are you trying to tell us something about books?
Yeah, of course. You have to. I have to confess that I didn't realize at the time that I was writing my first book, which has the title Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore, that writing a book with that title would make it a lot easier to sell to independent bookstores. That's sort of the very cynical approach. And happily, I did not even have the capacity for that level of cynicism. I was just like being a nerd. But... It turns out, you know, it's true, I think, of almost all media. Some of the best movies are about movies and people making movies and usually sort of like failing to make movies. And I think actually, in turn, some of the very best books are about books and writing books and what books even are for all of us who love to read.
You managed a line that has just taken on a life of its own. And you managed it on page 5. It just seems to stop people in their tracks, and people of a certain age are talking about this one sentence about the Hogwarts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have it? Do you have it on the page there?
You tell me.
I can't remember it. What kind of steel trap writer's mind do you think I possess?
Wait, I have
no,
the book.
No, okay, no, hold on.
Wait, no, I have the book right here.
I can take the challenge.
Okay.
There's a thing I believe about people my age. We are the children of Hogwarts, and more than anything, we just want to be sorted. So wise.
Let's talk
so
about
true.
That, shall we, Robin?
You know, honestly, the thing that has been amazing, and this is very different, even in the 4 or 5 years since my first novel came out, the way that books kind of travel around the internet has changed quite a bit. And in particular, you know, you can think of everything, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, as kind of operating on little social objects. Like, that's what they want. They actually don't want to transport entire movies or big complicated news stories or whole books. They can't. Like, the pieces that appear in that feed of yours, they have to be something that you can kind of grasp immediately and then either decide that you like or kind of go like, no, blah, who, someone is wrong on the internet, and like write an angry comment. That's the kind of substrate, you know, the matter of these networks. So books that can offer little bits, little isolatable chunks that can then flow kind of without context through these networks tend to do very well. Again, there's a totally cynical way of thinking about that, which is that you could engineer your novel to be full of these pithy little remarks
never
that people
your mind,
could kind of rip out. No, I'm unfortunately not that talented. It would take a real engineer, a real wordsmith to be able to do that. But so actually it's more fun and I think more interesting to just write a novel as best you can, kind of piece it together, and then see after the fact what pops out. I mean, I knew that I liked that line in the manuscript when I wrote it, but I never would have imagined that it would have taken on this life of its own. And so it appears in, you know, those sort of those Instagram posts where the text has been sort of reset and there's a little glitter around it or something. And sometimes it's attributed to Robin Sloan, the novel Sourdough. Other times it's not.
That's yeah, but just, if it's like Abraham Lincoln, that's
yeah,
okay.
That's just the way it goes. It's interesting. It's just interesting to see that that's part of the life of a book now in the 21st century. These little bits kind of get plucked and then whew, they just scatter around the world.
And of course, I didn't know that level of detail when I read the line on page 5. My first thought was, that's such a passive line that they want to be sorted and not sort things out themselves.
Yeah, I think it's true, though. And I'm always someone who resists generational analysis. I think most kind of arguments that are based on these ideas of these big groups of people with kind of common traits are just not true, honestly. I think there are these big generalities that serve corporations and like consultants more than anyone else. So actually, I think you could substitute in almost any generation in that line or any group of people or just people generally. I think that was part of the powerful appeal of that story. And in case folks don't know, it's a reference to the Harry Potter books, obviously various, like a series of books you might have run across in a rare bookstore. And early on in the very first Harry Potter book, you know, Harry, young Harry, encounters this artifact at the wizard school called the Sorting Hat, which does the most amazing thing. It tells you where you belong, and it tells you, like who your tribe is. And I think there's something just deeply compelling about that for anyone, everyone of any age.
Have you been sorted?
Have I been sorted? Well, yeah. I think my sorting hat, it wasn't quite as neat as, you know, the magical top hat. I think it was the public library. I think when I walked into the public library, however many years ago that was in Troy, Michigan, where I grew up, I was like, oh, yes. I understand now. This is where I belong. Yeah, these are my books and these are my people.
Yeah. Robin Sloan, when you wrote Sourdough, what made you think that you could invent a culture, the mosque?
Right. I felt like I had to because I was inventing some food. You know, I was inventing an artifact. I don't think there's any spoilers here, but the book kind of hinges on a sourdough starter that burbles and bubbles and has some strange, unique properties. And I didn't want to just kind of glom that onto some real existing culture. I didn't want to just take something from the world, whether it was, you know, Italian or French or Croatian or anything, Korean, and kind of just go, now you have this thing too that I invented. It seemed both more interesting to me and more responsible as a writer, as an inventor of things, to just come up with something fresh.
And they really, the brothers, were the catalyst for this whole story.
Well, the starter, I mean, when you're writing novels, I mean, I'm sure that there's some writers that are just, it's all sort of a grand design, and maybe they have an outline or a blueprint or a schematic, and they just, from the first page, from the first moment, they know exactly what they're doing. I've never met that writer. I would like to meet her. For more people, I think, it really is an act of kind of semi-controlled combustion. So in this case, it was really, and I mean, this may sound not very artful, in which case, fine, but really I needed a way to get this starter, this sourdough starter, onto the stage. And so you almost reverse engineer it. You say, okay, so it's very strange. It must have come to San Francisco from somewhere else, somewhere very different. Some people must have brought it. Ah, yes, these brothers. And they run a hole-in-the-wall restaurant, and they'll deliver this delicious spicy soup and sourdough bread to you. Wait, where did they come from? Ah, yes, they're part of this group of people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so it kind of builds one thing on the next. And of course, as you know, having read the book, their culture, this fictional culture, is really important to the whole story of the book and kind of where it all goes. But, I mean, it begins with solving these little problems that are inherent in putting a story together.
It's so important to the whole book and the whole story, but they're so mysterious, we never really find out that much about them.
Yeah, and that's by design. I'm a big believer in fiction that leaves a lot of gaps. I actually think that's the power of fiction. You know, you think about what happens on a movie screen, they show you everything. All the pixels, whether they're from the real world or rendered by computers, and you know, sometimes it's totally spectacular and mesmerizing, sometimes it's boring, but they show it all to you. It's all there. And books, fiction, it's different. You know, there's these sort of famous observations that say in a book like Anna Karenina, the book is called Anna Karenina, there's a very important character named Anna Karenina, she's never described. Like, you can finish that book feeling like you know this person and you know something really important about her life and her heart. There's no part in that book where you get the sort of paragraph, Anna Karenina was of medium height with honey brown hair and a rosy complexion. Like, of course not. And I actually think that's one of the signs of maturation as a writer. You learn how to leave more things out and leave more space for readers to kind of fill in the gaps. So I actually, at many points along the way, as I was writing this book, I resisted the temptation to kind of fill that in and have a whole chapter. I was like, well, actually, the brothers came from a group of people who live somewhere between Croatia and Hungary, and they blah, 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 and like fill in all that fun history, which is a fun thing to imagine. But I think when you fill in all the gaps, it actually takes something away from the potential of the experience.
Oh, to be a speck of dust in your brain. Oh my goodness. What fun. There's a line in the book, it always begins with humming. And you were referring to the sourdough starter when you wrote that, or when the character says it. But there's so much humming. There's so much music in the book.
Yeah,
aside from, I mean, the mother, the women in the Lois Club, who all have their own special sound, and the robot has its own special sound. So there's a lot of music within this, but there are four cuts that we're going to play this evening.
Oh, good.
Of the music that you know if you heard the audio book, you read about in print, but let me tell you, to hear them is something else. The four start with the Croatian folk music.
Yeah, well, I should explain because it's a little bit wonky. It's interesting how sort of imagination loops back around on itself. There is this singing that's important to the story. And when I was writing about it on the page, kind of describing this fictional music, I did have something real in mind, in my own head, and that is a kind of music from our real, you know, non-fictional world called klapa. It's a kind of sort of Croatian folk singing, choral, totally a cappella, and just, I mean, transportingly beautiful. It's one of these wonderful traditions of choral music that'll just kind of set you back on your heels when you listen to it. So I'd been listening to it for years, and that was in my head. This beautiful kind of otherworldly a cappella choral music was in my head when I was writing the book. Fast forward to the production of the audiobook, there was one small piece that I actually did play a direct role in, and that was when the audiobook producers came to me and asked, they're like, we don't know if you know, but audiobooks are a big deal now. I was like, yes, I know, they're a really big deal. What do you think we could do that would be different and special for the audiobook? And because they like to kind of just make it a little bit distinct to kind of entice people maybe to try that format. And for whatever reason, the first thing I thought of was that music. I was like, well, if I was listening to the audiobook and reading all these descriptions of this otherworldly music, you know, hearing the prose describing it, and then I never actually heard it, at least not even a little bit, I would feel kind of cheated. Kind of like, come on, just play me a little. So, using some code techniques involving machine learning and kind of asking computers to take that real music, that real Croatian folk singing, but then make something new, because again, I didn't want to just play Croatian folk singing in my audiobook, because some number of listeners, perhaps a small number, but still some number, would have been speakers of both English and Croatian, and then they would have emailed me, I'm sure of it, they would have emailed me, and they'd been like, I don't know if you know, but the song that the producers put in your audiobook,
it's about a fox hunt. Yeah, it really doesn't fit.
It's really very strange, and actually these days quite distasteful. Yeah, I was afraid of that. And so I used these techniques to sort of transform this music. The computer has the capacity to sort of pull out the patterns and some of the ways that the sound relates to itself so that what you get back is definitely musical. And also, as you'll hear, it has that sort of unmistakable sound of human something, but it's not Croatian anymore. In fact, it's no human language at all. It's nothing ever heard on planet Earth. before right now. Right, so that is the real stuff. That's the Croatian klapa music.
It also sounds a lot like Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
Well, I mean, it does. You see the kind of connections between some of these different languages and sounds, and the key is like just a kind of wonky key that we're not used to hearing music in, kind of in our rock and roll pop music traditions. But so that's where I started from. That clip that we just heard is sort of the starting place for this exploration.
Yeah, but let's hear the next one. If Dick Clark were here, he would not find it easy to dance to.
It's very strange. To my ear, it's strange in exactly the right way. It was an odd experience the first time that music came out of the computer. The way these systems work is they have to kind of churn and train themselves on the input data set, in this case, all those Croatian klapa MP3s, for quite some time. I mean, the process takes, even on a super fast computer, it takes several days, almost like slowly baking something is kind of what it feels like. And then finally the moment comes when you're ready to open the oven and look inside, see what has emerged. And I still remember it so vividly. I pressed play on the first few kind of samples that it created, just like that one that we just heard. And I thought, that's like what I imagined. That's what I kind of had in my head as I was writing those descriptions on the page. And that's a very strange, uncanny feeling.
But it's not sourdough starter yet. Is this closer? I don't want that in my kitchen.
I think it's important to say for listeners of the podcast that people in the room are palpably uncomfortable, which I count as a success.
That was the third of four. Is four? Have we reached it when we get to four?
Yeah, no, but I should explain because it's sort of a special sound or has some special kind of a special story behind it. The way this whole thing works, and you've likely seen other examples of these machine learning techniques online. People have been using these to create strange images. You know, this is the same underlying technology that's powering these self-driving cars and things like that. And it's really all based on these statistical models, right? Given this folder full of music, the computer doesn't know anything about music. It doesn't know anything about notes, about world sort of choral traditions. All it sees is these samples, you know, these little slices of data that all together form a waveform, which becomes a piece of music that you can listen to through your speakers. And it learns a model. It just learns kind of a probabilistic model. You know, it doesn't have to be sound. It could be text. It could be characters. And in that case, it learns, you know, trained on a corpus of, say, great English novels. It would learn with great sort of confidence that given the letter T and then the letter H, the next letter is going to be E, or maybe A or O, but definitely not J or X or Q, right? It just sort of forms, and you can imagine a bunch of sort of little certainties like that all chained together. You've got English. I mean, that's all it is. It's a way of putting symbols together. So it does the same thing with sound, and one of the things, these processes are not perfect, especially for me, who's kind of a perpetual enthusiast kind of hacker on this stuff, definitely not a professional. I would press, okay, you know, give me something new, computer, and it would produce silence. It would churn for like a half hour, working hard, like, yes, master, I will produce something wonderful for you. Wait till you hear this song. I would press play and go, huh? Silence. And that's because it learned, as it was building the statistical model, that in recorded music, there's a lot of silence. And that's easy. Given a moment of silence followed by a moment of silence, well, what's most likely? Another moment of silence. And then now that you've got three, there's definitely going to be another one, and it just stretches on and on and on. So that's disappointing when that's what you hear from the computer. But to flip it around, some of those magical songs that I heard back from the computer were these audio files where they would begin in silence, and I would first be kind of deflated. But sometimes I would sit and listen for a while, and it would go silence, and then more silence, and then more silence still. But then, remember, this, none of this is absolute. It's all probabilities that the computer has learned. And the probabilities are never zero. There's some tiny chance that out of nothing, something. And so that's what you're going to hear in this last one. It actually begins in silence, which is by design. And so for this first chunk of it, it's really just the computer saying, I am very confident that you should not be hearing anything. Not very confident. Like, there's always a, you know, 1/1000th of 1% chance that maybe it should be something else. And midway through this sample, we get lucky. And I think it is a really cool sound. That's the one. If you played it for me and said, oh no, this really is a piece of music from a, you know, very sort of almost forgotten Eastern European folkway, I would believe you. I think it sounds very convincingly human.
You fit a robot into sourdough, but not the whole robot, just an arm.
Yeah, well, this is one of the parts of the book that is nearly documentary, or, you know, kind of borders on nonfiction, because as some folks in the room might know, especially if you kind of work adjacent to manufacturing or even in laboratories or in warehouses these days, there are these robots, and usually it is just a robot arm, a big, beefy, sort of like six-jointed robot arm that can move in any direction, kind of a big octopus tentacle. It can kind of go all around and usually has a bunch of fingers, or maybe like a gripper or a suction cup or something like that. And they are so capable. I mean, truly, when people talk about the sudden rise of robotics and how they have leapt in the last, I mean, truly, like in the last decade, from being this sort of like ever, you know, always distant science fiction promise, like the jetpack or the flying car. And suddenly, I mean, truly, they are like leaping into new industries and transforming them, and frankly, transforming the work that people do. And these nimble, agile, super strong robot arms are a big part of that. And that's all real. That's not fiction.
What is the role of this arm?
Well, you know, it begins, our protagonist is a young software engineer, actually. She moves from Michigan, where she works on kind of motor control software for cars, to the Bay Area, where she's recruited by the company that, in my fictional world, is the market leader for these arms. The company's called General Dexterity, which I think that's a pretty great fictional name for a company, if I don't say so myself. And so at this company, the arms are being peddled to, you know, laboratories and factories, anybody who will use them. And it's hugely successful, and it is, in fact, changing industry and changing the way people work. Lois, our protagonist, midway through the book, she has left the robot factory. She's baking bread in a secret market. She gets her hands on a refurbished, like, you know, three generations old one of these robotic arms, and it becomes her assistant, essentially. I always think of the brooms in Fantasia, you know, Mickey, Sorcerer's Apprentice, and those brooms, that's what I think it is for her. I think
it's hers. Is it mixing the dough? Is it kneading the dough?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's
opening the oven.
It's mixing the dough. There's a few things it can't do, and this, of course, is true to life as well. The arms are, they're sort of genius dopes, because they're so capable at so many things, but there are certain tasks even now that you sort of challenge them with, and they're like, oh, no, I couldn't possibly do that. And so in Lois's case, it mixes the dough, it moves things around, it kind of lifts heavy sacks of flour, but it can't bake the bread. It can't do the sort of the most important work.
Do we overburden our robots with absurdity?
What do you mean?
We're asking a lot of a mechanical arm, we're asking things of a mechanical arm that may not be necessary or may not be practical or may not be useful. There's a whole part of this that has to do with the fact that the robot can't crack an egg.
Yeah, that's right.
How important is that for a robot to be able to crack an egg?
Well, I'll tell you, I think it comes down to this question of sort of repetition and craft, or maybe art. And this is something that Lois in the book actually grapples with. In her world, the world of technology, and this is true of folks working in the Bay Area and all over, people who make websites or make services, make products, the great power of that kind of work is that you solve a problem once and you are done, because you can copy the solution to everyone everywhere. You know, whenever there's an upgrade on the iOS software, it's not as if some Apple engineer has to come around to everyone's phone and be like, oh, let me just, I have to loosen this and tighten that. No, they do. I mean, it's a lot of work, but they do it all in one place, and then they press a button and shoom, it is instantly copied basically for free everywhere in the world. So that's one way of working. There's another way of working, and a good example is whatever your favorite local bakery is. And that's where, once again, very skilled people do really important work, and then they create this product, this delicious product, they sell to people that, as a sign of its success, is instantly consumed. And they're like, great, we did such good work on this bread and people love it. Wait a minute, now we have to make more bread. And I think that's delicious, actually, like that tension between the scale and the ease and the leverage of kind of code and technology and media, for that matter. I mean, I think that's the world of radio and TV and podcasts and books. And then this other world of, like, the point maybe is to do it again and do it again and do it again yourself as a human. So to answer your question, the reason that people want robots to be able to crack eggs is that means that egg cracking can now belong to that first world. It can belong to that world of repetition and copying and, like, this is solved. I'm going to move on to other things. I'm going to go on vacation. But of course, the reason that maybe some folks are not interested in having a robot arm crack their eggs is that they don't mind cracking their eggs every morning or baking their bread.
Some of the people are still looking at the stars. They're still looking at the skies. They're still fascinated with astronauts, which is sort of a combination of those. It's a good representation of that fusion.
Oh, I think so, definitely. I mean, that's, people sort of complain, some people, very pedantic people complain about human space exploration. They kind of go, oh, we're such our, with our, you know, tender, fragile bodies, we should really not be sending humans to space. We should just let the robotic probes do it. And we should send out robotic probes. But I think that the deep allure of putting humans up there in ships actually speaks something to our interest in that fusion. You know, I mean, truly, to think of a human being, and not just any human being, but an astronaut, like some of the most capable, well-trained people ever in, like, the history of anything, to imagine those people in, like, the space shuttle, which is one of the most complicated and really profound things that we as people have ever made, that's inspiring. Of course, they always, like, have to figure out things for it to be doing. They're like, oh yes, it's running a mission to see how plants grow in, you know, on the left side of the moon. But you're like, don't bother. Just go. Just be there and then come back. And, like, that's actually valuable. That's valuable work.
Your combination of old and young and old and new and merging, is that sort of your legacy? What do you see?
I mean, I think we should come back to around to where we started and the conjunction. What conjunction you choose. You said and a few times just then, and I am just always about the and. Whenever somebody wants to make me choose, I think it's a trick. Because I really think it is a trick. I think it's not honest. It doesn't correspond to how the world really works and what's really available to individuals and to whole societies. I think if we're clever and patient, I think we get to always say and kind of get the best of many different ideas and tools and technologies and everything else. So I think, I don't know what I'm gonna write next. I don't know exactly what the next book is gonna be, and I definitely don't know what the book after that and the book after that is gonna be, but I am confident they're always gonna be about and.
And we're very glad you came here tonight, Robin Sloan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Authors for Cap Radio Reads are selected by Capital Public Radio's content and marketing teams. Our podcast is produced by Sally Schilling. Recording engineer is Mark Jones. The executive producer is Joe Barr. You can find more information about the authors and books online, capradio.org/reads. Keep up with our latest conversations by subscribing to Cap Radio Reads on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Find them and more at capradio.org/podcasts. I'm Donna Epidone. Thanks for listening to Cap Radio Reads from Capital Public Radio.